We're in the middle of Shabtai Tzvi's manic episode in Smyrna. We've already seen his famous Shabbos, in which he chops down the door on Shabbos, claims it's tikkunim, takes over the city basically. Reb Chaim ben Avista changes sides, did all that. Now we're holding by Zion Tavis. It's a Tuesday. Now that Shabtai Tzvi has conquered the town, the Jewish part of the town is celebrating. And a rumor goes around that Shabtai Tzvi has never consummated his third marriage. Remember his third marriage to Sarah?
Wait, is he divorced out of
Jerusalem? The first two wives he divorced because he didn't consummate them at all.
Right.
So now there's a rumor going around that even his third wife, Tisera, the woman of loose morals, was never consummated.
Okay.
Now, my editorial comment is that's probably very extremely difficult to believe. Unlike his first two wives who were blushing virgins, as it could be said, Sarah was an experienced woman. I mean, there are people who accuse her of marketing her goods in earlier stages of her life.
So she got around.
Yeah, she got around. So kind of hard to believe that nothing had happened. Very hard to believe. I mean, they were married already now for 2-3 years. I just find it extremely difficult to believe. But nonetheless, the rumor goes around, and I can also throw out, this is my own personal theory, I'm surprised that Gershon Scholem didn't think of it, but it's very possible that Shabtai Tzvi is to blame for the rumors himself. Because as we saw, I believe it was last week, or maybe it was the week before, he had met his first two wives and had, you know, schmoozed with them. He had talked to his first two wives socially. So it's very possible that like they complained to him or whatever, so he said, oh, don't worry, I haven't touched this one either. So then from there, the rumors hit the city. So not only do the rumors hit the city that his third marriage is not consummated, Shabtai Tzvi has a revelation. Now is the time to consummate the marriage.
He's still manic, right?
What? Yeah, he's still manic. And not only is he going to do it, but in fact, his third wife is still a virgin. Yeah. And so they retire to a room and bring out a bloody sheet not long later.
To show the whole town,
that's right. Yeah, wow. I said, whoever didn't come tonight is definitely going
to
regret it.
That's a whole new meaning to hanging out of dirty laundry.
Whatever, okay. Right. That's a famous story. Things go on, Friday comes. Sort of like, I think this was 2 years, it was last year. Last year, Sarah Batavis fell out on a Friday. Right, remember that? That happens every so often. This year, Sarah Batavis, the year of this critical year, 1665. Tav Chavav, the 10th of Tavis, Sarah Batavis, also falls out on a Friday. And of course, Shabtai Tzvi abolishes the fast. Because he says the redemption is practically here. Now, this is very fascinating. And I'm going to say my own feelings a little here also. As Gershon Scholem points out, there is the last flickers of resistance of the Rabbanim, of the rabbis of Smyrna. And it's somewhat, you know, puzzling that if the guy was Machal Shabbos Barabbim, you understand. And there was certain resistance to that. But there was like another lunge, another you know, surge of resistance because of Shabtai Tzvi abolishing his arbitrators. Now, there's a major difference, you understand. Chil Shabbos is Chiv Kores. And Sarva Tevis, the end of the day, is the Rabbanim. And I'm not saying it's not important. Don't get me wrong. Rabbanim are important. But it is interesting that the Shabtai Tzvi's abolishing Sarva Tevis, you know, got such a strong reaction. if we think about it theoretically, in a halachic, theoretic sense. Now, if we think about it in a more emotional sense, I definitely emotionally understand why someone would react to abolishing a fast.
Why would you react more to breaking Shabbos?
I don't know. That is the point. The point in case that there's other things Shabbos has done also, that you know, he's eaten chalev and made brachas on it and all sorts of, you know, shenanigans. And that has a certain reaction. But it does seem there's a stronger surge of reaction over here, which does need explanation. So I'll tell you I like you know, mulled it over and felt, you know, saw what I felt about it. And I think I emotionally understand why someone would have such a reaction. And I think it's a combination of two factors. I think one factor is public versus private. In other words, Shabtai Tzvi, chopping the door down himself, he's not telling everyone to be Mechal Shabbos.
He said he loved masses in Mechal Shabbos.
He said what?
Did you not just say that he did God, what was it, Mechal Shabbos for Rabin or something?
No, but Farhesi, it means he publicly was Mechal Shabbos, but there's still a difference. That was a personal act of Shabtai Tzvi himself. It wasn't him telling everyone to be Mechal Shabbos. So that could be part of it. It's also very possible, you know, when something is a set part of, you know, the Jewish calendar, then people, that's like a very deep structural part of Judaism, and attempting to change that, it is just you know, that shows to an extent the depth of how far he really means to go. And it's also possible, you know, that you know, as we say, as it says in the Zohar, Yisrael Bereisu Kush Shabrich Echadu, the Jewish people, Hashem, and the Torah are all one. And, you know, the fast days, the Sar Batavis, the fast days, almost all the fast days are connected to Churban Abayis. And even though, you know, they're only through Abundant, but Lamais, they're connected to Churban Abayis. And because it's a Kfira in the status of Churban, which is very deep, which is a very deep part of the real identification of Yisrael, the Jewish people, possibly that's also a factor in the, you know, in the depth of the emotional depth of the reaction to Shabtai Tzvi's attempting to abolish, he abolished Asar B'Tavis, and what we should assume that the vast majority of the city listened to his ruling. So the Bezdin protests against Shabtai Tzvi abolishing Asar B'Tavis. And the result of that is they have to flee. They have to run away from their lives.
The Bezdin
has to run for their lives because they were personally threatened with death threats for kfira, for not accepting Shabbat Tzvi as Mashiach. And the basic situation in Smyrna is what I would call a massive messianic party. The Tshuva stuff probably had been going on a little before, but now they have a big mass messianic party. Yeah, some of it is they're trying to do Tshuva, but it also involves mass, you know, fake prophecies. No one's working, everyone's just partying all the time and having, you know, enjoying themselves and claiming to see Elio. Some person claims he sees a star fall from the heavens into the sea, and then go right back up. Yeah, okay. I'm just saying that's a type of vision a person would have, and when there's this state of mass ecstasy and prophecy and messianic ecstasy going on.
But none of these people were manic, so to say.
These people are not manic. This is, now if you want me to try to explain this in normal fashion, it's not so easy to explain. We are very jaded today. That means we're bland, and our here. Let me veer off and come back. This type of mass ecstasy and prophecy, speaking in tongues, is a relatively well-documented phenomenon amongst, you know, outside of the Shabdetsui experience. Quakers, etc., etc. You have other spiritual, very spiritual groups all around the same time having relatively serious, similar experiences. I'm somewhat puzzled. I said, today we live in different times, and people usually don't do things like this, at least not without substance abuse. Okay? People are not able to get to have such style experiences based just on, you know, meditations and you know, and emotional excitement, etc., etc. So it's hard to, if you're asking me to really quantify in a real fashion, I'm not going to be able to do my best here. Do my best now. Okay. Oh, yeah, not yet. Okay, fine. Okay. Okay, now we have here like this. This is like, we're halfway out of Smyrna now. Shabtai is going to leave Smyrna on the 22nd of Tevis. That's when he's going to leave. We're holding now Asar B'Tevis. He has sent letters out, you know, with his proclamations a little before, you know, the beginning of this period, maybe even Hanukkah, maybe even right after Hanukkah. The question, the historical question we need to grapple with is that some people come to and join up with him. When we get to Gallipoli, which we should get to tonight, and he's been in Gallipoli for almost at least 5 months. I didn't have time to track down the final, you know, denouncement. I think it was right before Yom Kippur, but it's hard to, whatever. I'm just using my memory. But he's in Gallipoli for a solid 5-6 months. And that gives a lot of people time to come, find out he's there, get the news, and come visit him. And that's where the key visit of the Taz's son, stepson, and grandson come in. That's where that key visit hits. In Smyrna, we know even he was in Smyrna now for a decent amount of time, but he only went manic Hanukkah, and he's only, from being manic until leaving, is no more than three and a half weeks.
What's Natan
doing now? Natan is back in Gaza. He's in Gaza sending out messages, sending out tikkunim, giving people Kabbalistic advice of how to ease the way.
He knows what's going on with
him. No. He does not know exact details. It's unclear how many of these details he gets and what he does with them. Unclear. The facts are, though, Shabtai Tzvi has acted, quote, in character. So, if Nathan would be there, he would have probably put a deeper twist on it than Shabtai Tzvi was able to put. But the Shabtai Tzvi has adopted Nathan's, formulae, and as a result of that, so he sends stuff out, and there are, and the problem's like this, there are a small amount of people who come and join up with him, but not a significant amount, and as we know, it took even averaging 10 to 14 days for news to get from Smyrna to Constantinople. And you don't have 28 whole days from the day he went manic until the day he gets there, until the day he leaves. It's basically impossible to say that anyone came. I mean, maybe there was pizzas of Derek. I mean, two times. So it could be possible. As an outside chance, possible that there's at least one person who came from Constantinople to visit Shabtai Tzvi. And there are reports of other people who came to visit him and joined up with him here in Izmir and Smyrna. And of course, the question is why? So we have two possibilities. One possibility is they got the reports of what he did in Smyrna and came. And that's only possible from Constantinople in an outside fashion. In other words, if right afterwards he sent messages to Constantinople after his first Manic incident, and they made it there very quickly, and they traveled from Constantinople very quickly to Smyrna, then yeah, it's theoretically possible they could have caught them right before he left. So that is possible. It's more likely though that as he made his itinerary clear, he told everybody that when he was leaving Eretz Yisrael, he said he's going to Smyrna and then on to Constantinople. So people knew that. So the people who were his followers said, oh, he's going to Smyrna, so maybe we'll try to chop him in Smyrna before he, instead of just meeting Constantinople. That's the more likely possibility. Now, on his way out of Smyrna, though, Shabtai Tzvi engages in one of his favorite pastimes. And that is appointments. And for that, I will open up and give you some of his appointments.
And people come to him.
People, he has a group of followers around him. And he makes appointments. We already saw he did a little bit of this before. Remember on Shabbos, when he called one of his brothers king of Rome, and the other one king of Turkey?
All appointments as he appoints
people. Yes, he appoints people, he gives them appointments. He gives them titles. We saw before he went to Yerushalayim, he picked out 12 people and randomly said, you're the head of this tribe, you're the head of that tribe. He made a guy who wasn't a Kohen, all sorts of stuff. He made this guy head of Reuven, this guy head of that, all sorts of interesting / funny stuff. So over here he does the same thing. Over here his theme is kings of Israel. That's the newest theme.
Kings
of Israel. Malchi Yisrael of Yehuda. He makes one person David HaMelech Ke'ilu, another person Shlomo, another person had bad luck and he's only made king of Aram Tzava. He himself was from Aram Tzava. That's S.Y. So, and it's a very famous S.Y. name for the records. He makes another one Uziah, Yehoshaphat, Chizkiah, Yosam, Tzidkiah. Yeah, he's going through. Wait a second. He makes one person Achaz, Yoram, and Achav.
And what are these kings supposed to be doing?
You're asked as.
Like, okay, cool, okay, king. Okay, but what am I
going to do? You know what we say? Anachsidah Shemaisim affecting the concussions. It was considered a great honor. If it was considered an honor, if he touched you with his scepter, with his silver fan, then being made a king is a much greater honor. It's even better than the Rebbe giving you an apple to eat. Okay. Make someone Asa, Rechavam, Amon, Yehoyakim. Oh, this is like so off, wait a second. Yeravam, Aviyah. Okay, now, I'm like sort of aghast at Gershon Sholem's lack of Tanakhic knowledge. Yeah, I'm like shocked. The truth is shocked. That he's only bothered. Someone who has a basic knowledge of Tanakh would understand that, let's say, a certain amount of these kings were not tzaddikim at all. Achav's no tzaddik. Achaz is a rival.
So what's bad with it?
So why would he give an honor? Why would he honor one of his followers by calling him a bishlam, calling the guy David and Shlomo, Yosef, Asa, Yehoshaphat? These are kings who are great kings.
Do you think Yerushalayim's
off? No. I'm not doubting the source. The source is an accurate source. No, but it's on one of them, who he names Yeravam, he says maybe he meant to insult the guy. Because this is one of the guys who originally was against him and they went for him. So he says, no, that's not true because he called someone Acha. Well, it's not only Achav, it's also Achaz, and it's also Yehoyakim. Yehoyakim and Achaz, the Gemara in Sanhedrin says, should not have had a Chel B'Noam Haba. The reason why they have a Chel B'Noam Haba is each one has their own reason. Achaz, because Chizkiah, his son, was such a tzaddik. And Yehoyakim, the only reason, he should have had no Chel B'Noam Haba. You know why he has a chel b'noam haba? Because he was not buried. He was brutally killed by Nebuchadnezzar, tied to a chariot, and had his body dragged all the way. His body fell apart from Jerusalem to Damascus. Purus Chomer Tikamer. He was buried like a donkey. In other words, he wasn't buried at all. He was left for the, you know, the vulture, for the vultures to pick at. So because of that, he has a chel gemara. So clearly, the guy who he named Yehoyakim, he didn't mean to insult either. And this is just an example of Shabtai Tzvi's delusionary ability to see Sharash and Neshama, and Ki'ilu, these people have the same Sharash and Neshama, and they're being misakin, they're fixing up the mistakes or the Neshama of that person. That is definitely what is going on in Shabtai Tzvi's delusions. And yeah, he does, you'll be happy to hear that he does maintain consistency. He maintains consistency and calls one of his brothers, King of Kings over the Malki Yisrael, and the other one King of Kings over Malki Yehuda. That, one brother is Ki'ilu Rome, and the other brother is Turkey. So he does maintain a certain amount of consistency, which I guess for people of, technical historical detail, that makes me feel that however manic he was, there was a certain method to the madness. Okay, so he does this a little bit before he goes on to Constantinople. Now the question is, why did he leave Smyrna? Did he leave Smyrna on his own, or he was expelled? He was forced to leave Smyrna. That's the question. Why did he leave Smyrna? So, back to standard problems, not that clear. Either one is possible. There are some sources that claim he was expelled, but the facts are, we know that Shabtai Tzvi had already declared his intent to go to Constantinople, so it's not. I don't see that it's mukhrach at all that he was expelled. I don't see it's mukhrach. I don't see we have to say that. He had declared intention clearly earlier. And he plans to go to Constantinople and conquer the Turkish Empire by davening with prayer. He's going to say Tehillim, and the Sultan and the Grand Vizier are going to get off their thrones and hand him their crowns. That's what he's going to do. Okay, he leaves Izmir, December 30th, 1665. Which is the 22nd of Tammuz. Now, he went by boat. There's two ways to go. If you're here, let me just make a quick map. This is not the world's greatest map. This is an approximation. Okay, just note the original basin. This is not really the world's greatest map, but Izmir is about over here. Constantinople is right over here. Okay? He's going to be sent over here, about to go over.
So it takes him up there.
He's going by boat like this. That's what he's doing. Now, it should take him 10 to 14 days, as mentioned. It should take him 10 to 14 days. It takes him 36 days. No one's sure what took him so long. Look, I don't know, one thing Shabtai Tzvi is known for is mikvah, is he likes to, go ahead and, do tefillah. And the fact that it's the middle of the winter and freezing cold doesn't stop Shabtai Tzvi. He likes doing it freezing cold. It's a kapara. It's atonement. It's physical difficulties, and it's atonement. And maybe he kept stopping the boat to do more tefillahs. I don't know. That's definitely a possibility you can't count, just discount. Now, the delay is important, not stam, because it gives the Jewish community in Constantinople plenty of time to think about what they should do. Because, again, the big manic outbreaks from Izmir happened not merely, you know, happened weeks before he left. Clearly, there was a record of what happened in Izmir had gotten to Constantinople at latest around when he's leaving. At latest. And that gives the Jewish community in Constantinople a full month to figure out what they should do. How do they react to this? Okay. Now, Constantinople, in case you're not aware, is the capital of the Turkish Empire. Baruch Hashem. Constantinople, there it is right there. Constantinople is the capital of the Turkish Empire. And while the issue of loyalty is important, but somewhat clearly more theoretical in other places, in the capital, it's much more important. You're under the high authority's nose, literally, and you must be much more careful with the steps you make and take, etc. So the Jewish community in Constantinople is in turmoil. They're in turmoil. The people, the masses at large, as far as we know, largely follow Shaltetzin. The masses follow Shaltetzin. The Rabbanim were very, very split into followers and opponents. The followers, of course, are called Maminim. The opponents are called Kofrim. Believers and deniers. There's a lot of strife in everyone's, both sides. In other words, you would think that the believers in the Shabtai Tzvi would have a Luna Pshuta and say, look, he's Mashiach, it's all going to be good, and don't worry about what happens. But that is, they are very, they're still concerned, and I'm not sure if we should say that's a clear pircha. That's a clear disproof to the Amunah Pshuta. So the Amunah, the supposed Amunah Shabtai Tzvi, I'm not sure about that. I have to think about more before I say that one. But everyone is very concerned about what to do. The most likely, even though it's not absolutely clear, it's relatively clear that the opponents of Shabtai Tzvi inform the Turkish authorities of his claims and suggest, ask the Turks to arrest him. So, what happens is, when Shabtai Tzvi arrives, he's arrested on arrival and put into chains. On arrival, he gets off the boat and they chain him up. Now, they don't have, you know, let me just step back. I mean, it's cute, so let's step back. You know, we're talking about the Turkish Empire in the mid-1600s. The concept of, what do they call it? Due course of law, do something of law, due process of law. Due process of law, in other words, that you only arrest, you can be arrested with minimal amount of proof, but you can only be held in jail for a significant amount of time for a theoretical crime in the United States today after you have what's a grand jury trial. Okay? And certainly to be accused of a real crime means proper witnesses have to come and you have a lawyer and they have a lawyer and they fight it out, and if both sides have the same level lawyer, then it's more or less a just way of applying the law. Right? Well, we're talking about Turkey in the 1600s. Due process of law was basically non-existent. Even compared, in other words, Europe at this time had higher conception of due process of law, but certainly if the king's honor was involved, it, you know, not much after this, there's a historical incident with Charles XII of Sweden, and he wants a guy killed legally. He has him killed. He has a guy accused of, okay, the guy wasn't completely innocent, but you understand it wasn't a fair trial either on the other side of the coin. So the fact that Shabtai Tzvi was arrested and not killed on the spot is a question. Like, this is the Turks. He's Jewish. Okay, they value the Jews as citizens, yes. As, I don't know, citizens, as positive part of their country. But the facts are, is he's a second-class citizen. That is a fact. A valued second-class citizen, but a second-class citizen. If they wanted to kill him, if he, a second-class citizen, is accused of rebellion, you could kill him on the spot. You don't have to have trial, arrest, trial, prove this, that, the next.
He could have gone off the boat and just sliced his throat.
That's right. He could have walked off the boat, and then he could have said, how are you doing, Shabtai? Or, they had guns. Yeah, sure, definitely. They could have shot him on the spot. Shot him, or they more likely would have, you know, used their swords. No reason, you know, no reason to.
Yeah,
that's right. So it's why didn't they? So that again is not so clear. Okay. Gershon Shalom's theory is that they were that as Shabtai Tzvi was not making an armed rebellion. He was, I mean, it's unclear, were the Turks aware that he claimed he was going to come to Constantinople, say Tehillim, and they're going to surrender? Did they hear that much detail? That's a good question. They may have. In other words, because they have a source, because we have the right. Because historically, it definitely seems like the rabbinic opponents of Shabtai Tzvi were informing the Turks, informed to the Turks, told the Turks what's going on. The rabbinic opponents of Shabtai Tzvi definitely would be willing to say that. So it is possible they heard that, and they were amused, and instead of killing him, rather they arrested him. Gershon Shalom also believes that the Turks were more motivated by economic disruption over the, you know, rather than armed rebellion. I'm not sure. He didn't really bring real proof to it.
What's
the economics? The economics are like this. Turkey and Poland have something in common. What they have in common is almost all trade in the countries in this time is in Jewish hands. That is what they have in common. Trading is not a Turkish occupation. It's not a Polish occupation. It's a Jewish occupation. It's a combination of Jews like to do business. That's one. Freedom. In other words, the Turks didn't. Turks were happy with the arrangement. And then it's self-feeding. That because most of the trade in Turkey is in Jewish hands, the Jews like to do business with Jews anyway. So it's like a self-feeding cycle that there were Jewish communities scattered. And they also had a lot of them are Yotzei Sfard. They have their connections to Venice, Genoa. They have their Murano, crypto-Jew relatives in Spain. They do, that's a fact. In Spain, Amsterdam, etc. This is a big nexus, a big network of Sfardi Jewish trading. So the facts are is that because the Jewish community is gripped, also the Jewish community in Constantinople is gripped by messianic fever, and they're not going to work. And Gershon Shalom theorizes, and he doesn't really prove to it, which is why I'm saying it's a theory, that this is why the Turkish Grand Vizier takes action. The Turks are Muslim. Okay. The Turkish government's like this at this point in time. The legal head of state is the Sultan. Now, as I mentioned, I believe last week and the week before, the original Ottoman Turk custom until, I would say around 1600, was whoever gains power kills all of his brothers. That was the original. They brought proof to it from the Quran. I don't know. Okay. After that, they decided that it was too violent. And instead of killing their brothers, they put all the brothers in a jail. It was a comfortable but well-guarded jail, which was called the cage. Now, the problem, as they say, is that growing up in an isolated, you know, sterile atmosphere without clear education exposure is not really the best way to groom good rulers of a country, of not merely a country, a massive empire. And this leads to clear decay in the Ottoman Empire. I mean, the Ottoman Empire is so massive that even with the decay, it's still a massive threat to anybody. There was no single country which could go head-to-head with the Ottomans until it takes a lot of decay until the mid-1700s, practically. I mean, you have to understand how much power. I mean, they were ruling Europe from Hungary, the entire Balkan Peninsula, part of the Ukraine, Crimea, Turkey, Iraq.
It's huge.
Huge. You know, Syria, Eretz Israel, Egypt, Libya, Tunisia. They were ruling all of that. That's massive. That is just massive. Even not ruled well, even in decay, they're a threat. Now, what has happened at this point is the historically famous Ahmed Kaprili is appointed Grand Vizier, Prime Minister. He's titled Grand Vizier, and he takes control of the Turkish Empire. And the way he does it is he kills anybody accused of bribery. You know, he enforces law and justice and puts the Turkish Empire back on good standing. Well, for the Turks, he was very good, and it's like sort of like ironic, you know. Yes, he was sort of what's called in modern terms an enlightened despot, that he wasn't just killing people for no reason, like Ivan the Terrible, or there's a Mazda, there was a Turkish emperor, a Turkish sultan who I can't remember his name right now. I think it was called I don't remember, it's something the Mad, Mahmud the Mad, or I can't remember. I can look it up and find out. Who just killed people just, you know, like to keep them in line for fun. So he killed people with a reason. But he, there's no question, if Ahmed Kaprili felt like it, he would have killed Shabtai Tzvi, and he should have. In other words, it's somewhat puzzling why he did it. But he is Grand Vizier, and he sends for Shabtai Tzvi shortly after he's arrested. 3 days afterwards, which should be January 2nd, 1666, and has a meeting with Shabtai Tzvi. We don't have even though we have a decent amount of records of legal court record, we don't have any court record of exactly what transpired in this meeting. He's going to have another meeting with Shabtai Tzvi, the famous meeting in, I believe, September. That we have a lot of record about, but this one we don't have so much record about.
This isn't where he converts.
No, he doesn't convert over here. No. I said the second we have much more. And he's very unclear. There's only one source which claims to report on what happened. And the claim is that Ahmed Kaprili asked Shabtai Tzvi, are you Mashiach? Are you claiming to be Mashiach? And Shabtai Tzvi says, no, I never said I was Mashiach. I'm just a rabbi from Jerusalem, which is sort of true, collecting alms, collecting tzedakah for the poor of Jerusalem. Ahmed Kaprili apparently, I mean, the facts are like this. Instead of killing him, he puts him in jail. And he could, again, Ahmed Kaprili is willing to kill people. He has killed, I don't know, as I recall in my source book on Turkish history, the number is thousands. He had killed thousands of corrupt Turkish officials. So if he's killed thousands of corrupt Turkish officials, he can kill one Jew too. Why didn't he kill Shabtai Tzvi? I don't know. Gershon Shalom uses what I call standard Shabtai Tzvi theory, which is whatever you're going to say about him, everyone knows that in interpersonal relationships, he was very strong. Charming and very strong, and apparently he charmed Ahmed Kaprili. And again, and the grand finale also, when he has the second showdown, apparently the same thing happened. And so this time, Ahmed Kaprili says, fine, go to jail. So they send him to jail. So he's in jail in Constantinople for around 2 months. Until April 19th, which is Erev Pesach. The first part of the time he was in a, you know, lower class, not such nice jail. a dungeon, a proper dungeon. But afterwards, he was transferred to nicer accommodations. Because a lot of, in other words, there are two types of jails in the old days. I mean, there are today also, but in the old days, it wasn't, white collar crime jails didn't really exist so much. If you were accused of crime, you were in the dark dungeon type of jail. But then there was another type of jail for, aristocrats / better offs who had connections in society that you couldn't just literally throw them in a dark dungeon. So jails like that, like the Tower of London, that was what the Tower of London was, for the records. If you've ever been to London, if you go to London, that's in the Bastille. You know what the Bastille was?
Yes.
Okay, well, that's what the Bastille was also. The Bastille was not a dark dungeon. Yes, it was a symbol of the monarchy's power, but it was not a dark dungeon. There were different rooms, and the Tower of London, the same thing. There were nice rooms and not as nice rooms, but in the nice rooms, if you were, if you had the money and the king and the right connections, the king would allow you to, have more or less do what you want, excluding for the fact you couldn't leave. What?
Prisoner in style.
That's right. So he goes from being first, he's in a dark dungeon, and then on to better accommodations. And of course, the reason is he does have a lot of followers in Constantinople, and a lot of his followers have a lot of money. And someone made a lot of money over there. And different numbers are thrown out, but Gershon Shalom's not sure which ones of them are real, which ones aren't real. But the bottom line is, whatever, you read it, you see, it's unclear, there's a lot of, the numbers, of course, people always like talking about how much money passes hands. That I know myself, I was once, years ago, my sukkah is next to, my next door neighbor has a sukkah, we have sukkahs on our peasants next to each other. So years ago, not my neighbor's there now though, years ago, about 15, 20 years ago, so I had a neighbor, they're sitting in their sukkah talking Lashon Hara, which they're not supposed to do. And they didn't realize I was trying to take a nap in the next sukkah. And not only are they talking Lashon Hara, they're talking Lashon Hara about someone who I knew. Claiming to know all sorts of the guy's business. And I was very amused that they knew really nothing. They only knew the third or fourth hand rumors. And I knew the guy relatively well. So I knew that some of it was obviously not true at all. And I almost said something. It was very hard for me to resist, but it's just very not nice. A voice comes out from the other, from beyond the wall, Lo Selech Rochel Ba'amelcha. Anyway. Right, about the Baskal, that's right. So anyway, the point is, the reason why I'm saying it is I know the Jews like talking about other people's money. So I'm very skeptical about the sums, how much, and how many times, and this, that, the next, who knows? But definitely a lot of money changed hands, and he was brought into better accommodations, and people were able to visit him. And some of the people who visited him were Rabbanim, and Shabtai Tzvi was in his normal state. And when he's normal, he looks like a tzaddik, a parush, as he's termed, a pious saint, matzik the din, accepting his condition. And Shabtai Tzvi puts, of course, his own twist on it, that yes, he sometimes he's captured, his neshama is sometimes captured by the klipas. And so it's very fitting that now not only is because his neshama is sometimes captured by the klipas, now his body is also being captured by the klipas, and that's why he's being jailed by the head of one of the main klipas, is the Turks. And yes, he's being jailed by the Turks, and it's very fitting, and he accepts it, and mustama, it's going to be mechaper, it's going to atone for all sorts of bad things which are supposed to happen to the Jewish people. Okay. We're going to stop it right here. Akan. We're going to stop here. We're going to see him. He's about to go to Gallipoli, but that's too exciting to do at the last minute of the class. And we're going to start there next week.